Now, I want to speak to you this morning about how to keep going. And I don't mean how to keep going physically, although some of you look as though you could do with that kind of word. And frankly, I'm not feeling that great myself. But I want to talk about how to keep going spiritually. How to end your spiritual race well. You know, the last laps of a race, I often say, are the hardest. And how can we finish this race of life with grace, but also with courage? With no diminishing in our spiritual desire, no lack of spiritual strength, but knowing that renewal day by day that comes through God's Spirit and through knowing Christ. How do we finish well without getting bogged down in the things of this life? That's what I want to talk to you about this morning. And I want to use as our illustration the life of Abraham. And we're just going to look at one passage. I'm going to keep that passage right to the very end. And if you stay awake, you might just work out what that last passage is. But I want us just to think about his story and think about his life. And think about, in particular, three cities that had a bearing on the life of Abraham. Now, we're first introduced to this man. In fact, he comes, if you read the book of Genesis, he comes quite out of the blue. It's a bit of a sort of, you know, complete about turn, or at least certainly a sharp right angle turn in the book of Genesis. Suddenly this man appears on the scene called Abraham. And we're told that he lived in a city called Ur of the Chaldees. And that was a real place. I mean, one of the interesting things about the Old Testament is that the archaeologist can take his spade or his trowel or his shovel or whatever it is they use. And you can go to certain parts of the world and dig it up and you find that what the Bible said was absolutely right. That the remains of these cities still remain. And if you go to that place today, if I remember rightly, I think it's somewhere in Iraq or Iran, in around about that part of the world. And others have in the past, particularly maybe just 100 or so years ago. If you go there, you discover that Ur was a very impressive city. You know, we kind of have the idea that the ancients were in some way very primitive. Now, they probably were in Scotland. But to be honest with you, in this part of the world, you know, they had probably running water, running fresh water. Their houses were impressive. They probably lived in bigger houses than we do. At least the rich of that day did. Abraham was a man of substance. He was a man of business. He was probably a man of position. We know that he had an absolutely stunning wife. And so everything there was going for him in that biggest city of the day, Ur of the Chaldees. He was probably a religious man. In fact, the name Ur probably takes its title, or the city takes its name, from the moon god that they worshipped. The likelihood is, if he was part of his regular culture, Abraham was an idolater. And then one day, into that man's life, who probably felt he had everything going for him, and we don't know how this happened, God speaks to him. And he says to him, Abraham, I want you to leave home. I want you to leave your business. I want you to leave the comforts of Ur. And I want you to go and live somewhere else. Now, I don't know about Sarah, his wife. I know a little bit about wives because I've been married to one for 30 years. But imagine, guys, going to your wife and saying, darling, we're leaving town. Now, my wife would probably say, that's great. Where are you taking me on holiday? And then you have to say, well, we're not going on holiday. We're just leaving. And she sort of looks at him a bit more suspiciously and says, right, okay, where are we going? I don't know. What do you mean you don't know? I mean, can you imagine him getting it in the neck for this? Well, if you don't know where you're going, dear, how will you know you're there when you get there? And he says, well, this God that has spoken to me is going to tell me when I reach my destination. Has he given you a map, Abraham, or Abram as he was then? And he says, no, this is off the map. Right, okay, where are we going to live? They're leaving their mansion house behind. And he says, well, we're going to be in a tent. Now, I would imagine that that may have caused just a little bit of marital tension as the two of them had that debate. And God is telling Abram, I want you to leave Ur. I want you to take your wife, but leave the rest of your family behind and go to somewhere. And I'm not even going to tell you where it is, but we're heading on a journey. Now, I want to say to you that the first secret of spiritual success is this. The first secret of keeping going spiritually is that we have to leave the old things behind. Now, you know, I think that's one of the hardest things that we ever have to do as Christians. And Abram found it hard because he didn't obey. Actually, yes, he left the city. But he took his father with him. He took his nephew Lot with him. And that was quite contrary to the command that God had given him. And, you know, I'm sure he had good reason. My father's an old man. And to look after him, Lot's father is dead. He's my ward. He's my responsibility. And instead of traveling light, he takes all this baggage with him, and it turns out that he doesn't end up at the place God had directed him. He ends up in another city called Haran. And we don't have a lot of information about what happened there, but it caused a delay on the plan of God for his life because there were certain things he struggled to leave behind. And in fact, the way the text in Genesis says is that when his father died, it was then that he left Haran and moved on. Now, actually, if you do the sums on that, you find it doesn't quite work out. And it may be that it was when Abram considered his father as good as dead that he was able to leave and move on to the land that God had promised him. Now, I think there are lots of things that we hang on to that we don't actually even appreciate sometimes. The things that we think aren't important are a lot more important in our lives than we think. Just my daughter and her husband, they have three children and a tiny house. It's just a small two-bedroom job. And they've been up visiting friends for a wedding. And they live in this palatial mansion up there, just outside Inverness. And we were just sort of saying on the way down in the car, you know, it must be tough when you see some of your friends with their six bedrooms and you've got to squeeze three young kids, five and under, into one little bedroom at home. But actually, what matters? What really counts in life? Is it to be able to show your three young children that actually you can be satisfied with a little? That the secret to life is contentment and not the desire for things? See, I think within us, there's a whole lot of things we don't like to leave behind. You know, I'm getting to an age now where I'm worrying about my pension. And I won't go into details, but I do have good grounds for worry, let me assure you. And I begin to think, what is it I am worrying about? Is my bank balance my security? Or is God saying, Eric, I want you, if you want to be able to run with grace and with spiritual vigor, there are some things that have to be left behind. You know, I don't know about you, but I do have a hankering for the old days. You know, both my parents were children during the war, and I like to hear and love to hear, particularly my father telling about his war experiences, and frankly he likes to tell the stories as well because he never stops talking about it. And there's a bit of me inside thinks, oh, you know, they must have been great days. In fact, they weren't. They were really tough days. You know, and they say that the good old days are really the combination of a bad memory and a good imagination, and I think my father has a touch of both. And of course, we tend to, in our memories, sort of, at least for most of us, cast aside and cast out the things that were difficult and just remember the good and put a gloss on it. Sometimes we do that in church life. You know, we think, oh, well, it wasn't like this in the 50s or the 40s or the 60s. You know, what a world we live in. And we want to go back. Remember the Israelites, they complained to Moses about the manna. And, you know, they actually, you can read the text for yourself. They literally said, we want to go back to, what was it, the leeks, the onions and the garlic of Egypt. Now, that is one group you wouldn't want singing, Breathe on Me. You know, and we're all at that. We want to go back. Remember Peter? Everything, all his hopes were centered in the Lord Jesus. And he's had to watch him die and be crucified and dragged away. The man who was going to be king, who was going to release them from the bondage of Rome, hangs on a Roman cross. And he says to the boys, fellas, let's go back to our boats. Let's go back to Galilee. Let's do the things that we know best. We're not politicians. We're not disciples of the Messiah. Let's go back. And they go back to their boats, and they're out there on the lake. And you know what? The thing they thought they could do, the thing that Peter thought they would be successful at, they couldn't even manage that successfully. They're toiling all night. And then somebody from the shore says, try throwing your nets on the other side. Now, I'm not a fisherman, but to me, you know, you've been fishing the whole thing all night, and the guy just says, throw your net on the other side of the... I mean, these are not big boats. And out comes a huge trawl, and they realise who it is by the shore. And there at the end of John's Gospel, Jesus says to Peter, Peter, do you love me more than these? Now, you've got to watch how you address that, and the secret really is to unpick the Greek a little bit. Jesus is not saying, do you love me better than the rest of the disciples? He's saying to Peter, Peter, do you love me more than these? And he points to the fish. Peter, do you just want to go back to your old life, to the old business, to do the things that you're more comfortable with, or do you want to come on a journey with me and leave these things behind? And Peter struggled with that. He knew what Jesus was asking him. He knew his failure. Not just that he deserted in Jesus' most needful hour, but that really he'd said, let's just go back. Let's go back to the way it was. So there's a city behind us. There are things that if we are going to run this race with vigour and with desire, there are things that we need to be prepared to leave behind. There's a city behind us. And then the next great city that you find in Abram's life is Sodom. Now that was an interesting place. I think this time, and read the text carefully in the light of what I've shared with you, and I think by the time Abraham and Lot get to Sodom, Abraham had learned his lesson, because he doesn't go to live in Sodom. He'd been in Haran for long enough, that had held him up. And this time Abraham lives and stays in his tent. But Lot doesn't. And Lot looks at that city. Abraham, though, keeps his distance. And I think Abram's right. You know, if we want to run the Christian life with vigour, if we want to keep going to the end, there are some things that we have to stay separate from. Now, actually, that's not a particularly popular message today. And we have four children. They're getting older now. We only have one still in her teenage years, but we still have three at home. And, you know, I think one of the important lessons, perhaps the most important lesson, that we've had to teach our children more by example than by what we've said, is that there are things that we need to be separate from. Now, so often in our Christian culture, what we want to know is, where is the line and how close to that line can I live without crossing it? It's just the wrong way of approaching life. Because what you find is you play close to the line, and before you know it, you fall over the line. Abram knew there were some things he had to be separate from. Lot thought he could handle it. And in fact, if you just read the text carefully, it says in Genesis 13 that Lot looked up and he saw Sodom It looked like a nice place to live. And then later on, it says he moved in. So the first thing is he sees, then he moves in. And then finally, in chapter 19, he's at the city gate. Now, in our culture, that doesn't mean very much. You know, and frankly, we don't really have gates of our city, but who would want to spend their time doing that anyway? But in those days, to be at the city gate meant you had a position of power. In fact, it may even have meant that you had control of the taxation. It was a bit like being Chancellor of the Exchequer for that city. Because you could decide who could come in with their goods and sell them at the market in Sodom. And Lot is at the door of that city. He's right in with its culture. And then God says to Abram, Abram, I'm going to bring judgment on that place for its wickedness. And you might remember the story. Abram starts to plead for Sodom. Because somebody that he loves lives there. And he says to God, God, what about if there's 50 righteous people in that city? Would you still destroy it? And God says, no, I wouldn't destroy it for the sake of 50 righteous. By the way, remember that. That might be one of the reasons that God withholds his judgment on our land. But he said, what about, okay, if there was 45 and 40? And so he bargains with God, and eventually he gets down to 10. And God says, for the sake of 10 righteous, I'll not destroy that city. Now, you need to do a little bit of investigation here. But Lot had a wife, so Lot and his wife, that's two. He had four daughters, so 2 + 4 = 6. And two of them were married, so he had two sons-in-law, so add the 2 to the 6, and you've got 8. If Lot had just been able to evangelize 2 individuals, that city would have been saved. But you see, his compromise didn't lead to effective evangelism. That was all it needed, just 2 converts. And you know the story how God eventually destroys Sodom because there weren't even 10 righteous living in that city. And by the way, it says in the New Testament, Lot is described, I think it's in Judas, just Lot. He was a believer. But you see, he couldn't run the race effectively because of his compromise, because of the city he went to live in. So there's a city behind us that we're to leave behind, but there's also a city beside us. And the question is, how do we live beside that city? Do we never engage? If you read on, what happens actually is that before Sodom is destroyed, there are 5 kings of the plain that they lived in, and they attack Sodom. And Lot and his wife and family are taken captive by this lot. And Abram raises a private army of over 300 men. And he goes after those kings and those who have been captured from Sodom. And he rescues them. And he brings them back to Sodom. In their time of need, he goes to help them. And actually, it's very interesting. It's right at that point that Melchizedek appears, and without going into the detail, I believe he's a picture of the Lord Jesus. He appears with bread and wine, which kind of sounds a bit significant, doesn't it? Just right out of the blue. It's as Abraham goes to their aid that Melchizedek appears. So we live beside a city. And while we have to remain separate from its lifestyle, it doesn't mean we don't engage with it. And let me tell you, there is nothing more exciting, I would suggest, for those of us who are believers, than when we start to engage with that city but remain separate from it. So there's a city behind us. There is a city beside us. And then finally, I want to read our passage of scripture for this morning, and I wonder if you can think where it might be. It's in Hebrews, and it's in chapter 11. And I'd like you to turn there, if you may, or if you will, to Hebrews chapter 11, verse 8. Hebrews 11, verse 8. Now remember, there's that city behind Abraham. There's that city beside Abraham, and look what the writer says here. By faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went. Now, you could write in there, eventually. But he did go, he did eventually obey, and he went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. Now watch verse 10. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations whose architect and builder is God. Abraham had a city behind him. There was a city beside him. But actually, according to the writer of the Hebrews, what really motivated him was that there was a city ahead of him whose foundations and architect and builder is God. Now it says he lived in a tent. A tent is a dwelling that is only temporary. And we are living in tents. These bodies are just tents. Now frankly, I'm getting to the stage now where I'm quite glad of that. I'm glad it's not a permanent dwelling. I could do with an upgrade. But the Bible says we are looking forward to a city designed, built by God, the foundations of which can never be shaken. Now they say a vagabond has no home, a fugitive is running from home, a stranger is away from home, but a pilgrim is heading home. And we are pilgrims heading home. Now, my father has a saying. It goes something like this. In fact, all his grandchildren now, he has 13 grandchildren, and usually their departing comment to Grandad Scott is, "Grandad, keep looking up." Because that's what he says to them. It's kind of one of his sayings. Now, actually, he doesn't mean, and I think they know what he means, he doesn't mean, you know, keep looking to the sky. What he's saying is, keep looking forward. Because we're looking for a city, the foundations of which cannot be shaken. And I think that, in a sense, is the real key to how we keep going spiritually. There are things in this world that hold us back. Things that we are to leave behind. Things that we are concerned about which frankly do not really matter. Or sometimes we get so, but we do a lot. We get involved in the wrong way in the city beside us. And we get stuck behind, we get stuck with the thing beside us because we're not looking for the city that's ahead of us. You know, there is something lovely about going home, isn't there? If you've travelled a bit, and maybe not quite when you're on holiday, but God's been very gracious, and from time to time I've got to go abroad and speak in different places, and we've had a couple of trips to India and to Romania and to West Africa and different places. And there's just something nice about knowing you're going home. Maybe it's different when the family are with you, but when you're there just on your own and you get on that plane and you just wish you could click your fingers and get to that front door. And that becomes your only focus. It's the only thing you can think about. You know, it makes the journey a whole lot longer, it seems, on the way home because you just want to get home in those circumstances. Keep looking forward. Keep looking for home. A few years ago, a friend in my church gave me a book to read. And the book was called Heaven. It was interesting because he was an undertaker. And he said to me, "Eric, I'd like you to read this and then I'd like you to tell me what you think of it. I'm not quite sure what to make of it. I think I know what I want to make of it, but I want you to read it and I want you to tell me what you think of it." And it was a book, if you've not read it, you need to get hold of it. It's a pretty weighty tome. It's called Heaven by a man called Randy Alcorn. Go on to Amazon, you'll get it for, I don't know, £15. I tell you, you will never have spent £15 more wisely. I remember putting that book down as I finished reading it, and maybe for the very first time in my life, saying, I'm not sure I want to be here anymore. Because the prospect that lies ahead of us is just so fantastic. And you know, there was a couple of things about my misconceptions of heaven. Because he said, you know, the problem that we have with heaven, and in a sense we get this from the Greek philosophers, believe it or not, some ideas have permeated our thinking, is that when we get to heaven, it's kind of less than what we have here. You know, well, it'll be nice in heaven, but. Or in heaven there'll be no, and you can fill in the blank. And he just said, that is completely the wrong way to think about it. It's heaven is this life, plus, 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 plus. With a new universe just to explore. The Bible finishes with a new heaven and a new earth. Now, I'm not sure all that means, but he says that we'll have new bodies. And we know for sure, because the Lord has one of these bodies, that they look kind of like this one. So I'm assuming from that the new heaven and the new earth will look kind of like the one we're in, but just different, just much more glorious. You know, I've recently got interested in astronomy. And with the Hubble telescope out in space there, it's amazing the things we can see. You know, I rather think in that new heaven and new earth, we'll get to explore those. I can't think that God has made all these planets just so that we'll just see little pinpricks in the sky. Now, I don't know, that obviously doesn't float your boat, but it floats mine. You know, I'm looking forward to that. And in the book, you know, we've got a dog at the moment who's a bit of a pain in the neck, to be honest with you, but we had another lovely dog who was a Christian, obviously. And I'm looking forward to seeing him again. And he said, why not? Could God not recreate your dog? Why not? Why can't he do these things in heaven? Now, there's somebody out there laughing at me, but I'm dead serious about this. If you've got a dog, you'll know what I mean. Now, that is a silly example. But heaven is this. Plus, plus, plus. And for some of us, it's going to be a fabulous reunion. Those that have gone on before. And you'll barely recognize them. And there'll be a joining so that there will never again be a parting. But then in his book, Randy Alcorn says this, and this for me was the most memorable statement he made in all those pages, and the book probably runs for 300 or 400. He said, listen, heaven will be eternity. Time won't run like it runs now. And he said, could it not be that one day you will walk, just you, with your Saviour? And the two of you will get to talk together. And at first I thought about that and I thought, well, you know, you read Revelation and, well, we're all in a big choir, and I'm not much of a singer. I might be then, but I'm certainly not now. I'll be on the back row somewhere. And then the more I thought about that, I thought, why not? Why could it not be that one day I will put my hand in his, and somewhere on that new earth I'll walk with him and I'll talk with him, just me and him. And I'll look at those hands and I will see the prince for myself. I'll see that scarred face and I will look into those eyes. Now listen, if that is going to be, if one day you and I will have that walk and that talk, then what kind of people should we be here? Because if that is true, then surely that is going to make all the difference to how we live now. That one day we will see him, and one day we will talk to him. Now, as I think about that, I get a whole lot more anxious to leave behind that city. Whatever your city, we all have a different city to leave behind. But boy, I would hate to walk with him one day
and think about the things I hung on to that I should have left behind.
Or I'd hate to walk with them one day and think about the city I lived beside but just got too close to and hung on to. And surely if I focus on what lies ahead, then it will be a whole lot easier to keep going with grace and determination and desire right to the end. You know, I think how we finish matters. Finish well, I think, is a good saying. And I suspect there are many of us who have been on the road a long time here this morning. I know I have. But I tell you, one of the things as I get older, I'm determined, is that I'll be a good finisher. I don't want to finish just stumbling over the line, but just have kept that desire for glory that will allow me to finish well. May that be the desire of all our hearts.